belongs to the state. So if you're taken into hospital and pronounced dead, they can take your liver, your kidney, any part of your organ and use it for transplant, unless you have opted out. Now, there's an interesting moral question, whether or not we should have an opt-in system, a gift, a donation system, or whether we have an opt-out system, which implies that you are responsible for deciding, I do not want to do this. It's interesting, if you look at the Jewish or the Muslim faiths, the way in which they regard the body is sacrosanct and you ought not to touch, which is why the whited sepulchres, you ought not to touch a dead body, you are unclean. And Muslims, when they prepare a dead body, have to go through a ritual purification process in order to do that. And so how we handle the dead is very interesting. Opt in or opt out. But we already have taken organs from animals. There are people walking around. I met a lady today after the chapel service who told me that she'd had heart valve surgery. And there are organs taken from, but these organs are very unusual because, of course, they are inert. They are dead. They are not living tissue. And so you'll know that the problem for all transplantation is immunosuppression. What happens is you become, in order to stop you rejecting the organ, they have to give you drugs. The drugs lower your immune system, and that makes you vulnerable to all kinds of disease, particularly pneumonia. And so the only way they can get you to accept an organ is by making you vulnerable to other kinds of disease. That's the problem if we are taking live tissue. And we're talking about tissue, we're talking about bone marrow, we're talking about skin, and we're talking about pancreatic islets. Last Tuesday, I was in Washington, D.C. with the Secretary of State for Health's xenotransplantation meeting here in the United States. We had a presentation from Mexico City where they have been taking from pigs, from their pancreas, little islets, and encoding them, covering them with a little skin, which allows things to go through them but not to go out from them. And they've been putting them into the bodies of teenagers who suffer from diabetes. 13% of the population in Mexico suffer from type 1 diabetes. That's compared with 6 to 8% in the United States and in Europe. It's endemic, partly because of the history of the Spanish and the Indian, the native Indian in that context, and partly because of they love Coke, the kind you drink, rather than any other kind. And that's meant they are very vulnerable. Now, these kinds of experiments are trying to help people with diabetes. And given the overweight nature of American society and given the rise of particularly type 2 diabetes, this is going to be a technique which will be much appreciated. Certainly in Sweden, they've been highly successful in using material from the pigs of pancreas. I could also, of course, have taken you to Birmingham, not Alabama, but in Britain, where they're taking brain tissue from pigs' brains and from fetus brains and inserting it into the brains of people suffering from Parkinson's disease to try to overcome the disease. So it's not just issues from tissue from the pancreas, it's not just full organs, it's also brain cells they're using from animals as well as from other human beings. We live in a world where existing biotechnology already is there, and we can overcome the shortage of organs. We can help limit the loss of life. We can overcome the anxiety of long waits. We can ensure genetic compatibility. That's the biggest improvement. And that means we can stop having to say to relatives of those who are newly dead, is it all right to take the organs? My family, they're very interesting because I was in a situation where I thought that it would be useful if I gave my organs away. As a Scotsman, I hate spending money. And I discovered, because I went to a funeral, the cost of a funeral is really pretty frightening. So I thought about this and came up with a brilliant idea. I went home and I said to the family, good news, you will not have to pay for my funeral. Now, like any good Scottish family, they became very excited. Ha, ha, ha! So it's very simple. What we're going to do is I'm going to leave my body to medical science. No body, no funeral, no funeral expenses. Now, while they were delighted at the idea of saving money, they were not thrilled at the idea of Oxford or any other students chopping up little bits of David. So I went to see my lawyer. I said, whose body is it anyway? He said, David, it's your body, and you can do whatever you want with your own body, but imagine you die at home. Hospital hears you're dead, send down an ambulance crew, and they say, "We're very sorry that David's dead, but he's left us his body, and we've come to collect him." And the family say, "Over our dead body." They say, "No, no, it's his dead body we've come from." Family say, "You can't have him." So they break down the door, and they take the body. "No, no, you're in a road traffic accident. You're pronounced brain dead." They say to the family, "This is terrible. It's tragic, but your loved one thought about it. He or she has filled in that box on their driver license, or they carry a card which says you can't take the organs. We'd like your permission." But if the family say, "No way, Jose," it doesn't happen. See, our bodies are not our own. They depend not on what you and I decide, but on what families decide. And this would be a way of overcoming having to ask families. But there are some risks with this. It's important we understand the risk. The risk of infection from animals. I come from the land not of the free and the home of the brave, but the land of BSE. We have mad cow disease. We have had it big time. In America, you have it as well. It's just they're not quite as honest and open about the degree it suffers. But nevertheless, it's still a problem worldwide. Now, why is it a problem? It's a problem because material from animals moves into the human chain with fatal results. There's a risk of infectious disease. And we do not know what the infectious disease, if you take a pig's liver or a pig's heart or a pig kidney and put it into a human being. There are certain viruses called retroviruses, which all animals have. We have them, but they're inert. They sit in our body, they don't do anything until and unless you cross the species line. So if you take an organ from a sheep and put it into a pig, then you will find that the retroviruses kick in. If you take an organ from a pig and put it in a human being, our fear is the retroviruses will kick in. And we have no idea what kind of disease that will lead to. We have no idea how infectious people will be, but we're certainly taking it very seriously. In the UK, we have plans to remove people from society and to put them into an enclosed isolation area forever if this happens. So that's how seriously. And the discussion last week with the Secretary of State's group was whether or not we can remove people from society forcibly and whether or not new legislation is going to be required in every state of the Union and federally in order to make this possible at all. How far will we go? We know that there are effects of taking organs and passing them on from generation to generation. HIV, BSE, CJD have shown us those kinds of problems. That's just the physical risk. What about the psychological risk? If you get a pig's liver inserted surgically, are you all going to wake up and say oink oink? Now, we may not find that particularly amusing, but it's interesting. We've done experiments. We've asked people, and we've seen that if you say to a woman, "You have received a man's kidney," nothing happens. If you say to a man, "You have received a woman's kidney," 67% of men will reject the organ. If you say to an adult that they have received a child's organ, then the adult will reject the organ. Physically, there's something kicks in psychologically as a result of having organ transplantation. What will happen if we take organs from animals? We do not know. That's why we need regulation. That's why UK ZERA, or the Secretary of State's Xenotransplantation Authority, and the Council of Europe, and the Australians, and the Canadians are all working together to make sure that there will be no human experiments until we are ready. We have a balance between risk and benefit. But there's a second area which ought to concern us, and that's the area of animals. You know that animals, and some animals are particularly intelligent. We know that dolphins, in terms of their ability and in terms of their language, are able to communicate with each other. Now, of course, the danger is that we are guilty of what's called in philosophy the pathetic fallacy. You look at your dog and say, "Oh, here my dog is smiling at me," where really it's suffering from gas. What you need is to, how do we make a judgment about what capacity animals really have? Do they really feel pain? And Peter Singer has argued, in fact, animals feel more pain than the neonate, the child in the womb, more pain than the person suffering from Alzheimer's, more pain than the neonate even. Is there a distinction between animal as opposed to human pain? Do we think that we should save animals before we save human beings, or vice versa? If it's a burning fire and you've got a choice between saving your dog and saving your granny, which one do you save? It's interesting that we're finding more and more groups are protesting. PETA have been protesting yet again about the treatment of animals. And we've drawn limits. We have a shop here in the United States, as you have in UK, and I find a very difficult shop. It's called the Body Shop. And in spite of the fact I go every week and ask for a new one, they won't give me one. But one of the adverts for the Body Shop is, we do not test our cosmetics on animals. And so as a community, we're beginning to say there are some things we will not do with animals. Now, what's the basis? Is it emotional? Is it capacity for suffering? Or is it a doctrine of stewardship? How are we to recognize that human beings share some characteristics with animals and yet are different? How are we to draw that? Now, it's interesting that in Oxford, animals are more protected than human beings. If you have animal experiments, you have to fulfill what's called the Animal Procedures Act, and that requires a special protocol. If you experiment on embryos, you don't have to fulfill those kinds of grounds. So animals, in fact, in the UK and in Europe are protected more than human beings are protected. What do you give an 18-year-old for his or her birthday? When they come of age, I want to make a suggestion. What you should give them is a pig. Now, however, this is no ordinary pig. This is a genetically modified pig. And everywhere your 18-year-old goes, the genetically modified pig goes as well. Now, if there's a road traffic accident, this is when the pig becomes very, very important. This morning, my wife had bacon and egg for breakfast. Now, if you've ever had bacon and egg for breakfast, even downstairs here, you'll know that what happens is that the hen makes a donation, but the pig is totally committed. And what we're looking for is total commitment on the part of your 18-year-old's pig. Your 18-year-old's liver is damaged, the pig donates a liver. Your 18-year-old heart is damaged, the pig donates a heart. And because it has been genetically modified, the 18-year-old will not reject the organs. I could take you to a place not very far from Oxford where we have the best kept and the most expensive pigs in the world. They live in luxury. They live in an air-conditioned unit. They each have their individual styes made of soft plastic and rubber. They're too expensive to put together, so we keep them separately. They have toys, they have pipe music, they even have TV. They see a vet twice a day, they're fed on a special diet. And all that is required for living in that land of piggy luxury is that if and when the xenotransplantation authorities say, yes, you can take the organs and use them, these pigs will lay down their lives for humanity. Should we keep animals in these kind of unnatural conditions? Should we genetically modify animals so that the pig becomes more like a human and so that humans become more like a pig? How far do we change and cross species lines? Now, a number of committees have looked at this question, and they have decided that we ought not to use primates. I was very surprised last week, therefore, to learn in parts of the United States and in certain hospitals, you have been doing primate operations where organs from pigs have been put into baboons for the past 17 years. Now, that would not be permitted anywhere in Europe. In fact, much of the research in this area is having to move out of Europe because of animal legislation. They don't use primates, one, because they're endangered species, and secondly, because they're frightened about the kinds of diseases that primates have. Others suggest that we ought not to use pigs because they are actually quite friendly, clubbable kind of people. When is a pig not a pig? How much do you have to change the species line in order to change the very nature of pighood? Now, those who actually are concerned about xenotransplantation have piggeries. What's interesting is that there is a suggestion, and those who clone Dolly are following this, that every hospital should have its own piggery beside the hospital, so that instead of having to go to some special lab, you could just be able to give them. And the University of Georgia has just built a new facility where you are going to be able to have transgenic pigs, and you'll be able to have, if you have enough money, your own pig kept there, and certainly medical researchers will be able to take organs from animals and use them in that kind of way. How far are we going to do? Now, I want not to talk about the science. I want to talk about the morality and how we as Christian people begin to reflect a little bit on xenotransplantation. First of all, I want to suggest that we recognize that we live in a pluralist society. We live in a secular society where there are many different moral values. And sometimes Christians fail, one, to realize the opportunity, and two, to be appropriate in that pluralistic world. If you believe that God created humankind, if you believe that God gave a sense of morality in the hearts and minds of men and women, of course it can be darkened, it can be deadened, it can be killed, but there is a basic sense there. Then we have some basis that we can appeal to. And I encourage us as Christians to explore the common ground. Is there a basic morality that we can appeal to which will help us draw lines when we deal with moral issues? Is the goodness of God such that in his common grace he has actually given an awareness of certain fundamental values? Let's explore that common ground. Secondly, let's ask the question, what is natural? Now, this is not an easy question, and Roman Catholic theologians have had all kinds of difficulty about how you draw lines about what is natural, because today's new technology is tomorrow's commonplace. What began 25 years ago as new kind of heart transplant technique now is happening 5, 6, 12 times a week in many large institutions. So, of course, what is natural, our perception of it might change and adapt, but that doesn't mean there aren't basic natural functions that we cannot get towards. We need to ask, is there a proper kind of concern for nature? And that's where Scripture becomes very important. It's very interesting that in Genesis 9, for the first time, we have a permission for humanity to eat human flesh. But notice they were to eat human flesh, not for sport and not for fun, but in order to live. This morning, we were sitting, waiting in the new center, accommodation center, and we were looking at the decor, and my wife commented on the awfulness of the color. And then we spotted the painting. It was a very interesting painting because we didn't recognize it as natural Kentucky habitat. It was actually a fox hunt, I think set in the UK. And it certainly made us look as if we were at home. Now, it's interesting. Fox hunting is hotly debated in the UK because there people are not killing animals to live. They're killing animals for sport. And do we want to look at whether Genesis 9 is about using animals in order to live and survive and flourish, or whether or not we believe that killing animals for sport is or is not permissible? It's interesting that, of course, animals eat animals. That's part of the world in which we live. But not animals were given to the Jewish people in order for them to eat. There were very clear distinctions between what was clean and what was unclean. As far as we can tell, the basis of that was because of a concern about public health. There was a concern about vulnerability towards disease. And again, God in his goodness has made the world so certain ways of living, certain kinds of eating, certain kinds of behaving are good for people, and certain kinds of eating, living, and behaving are bad for people. The Old Testament dietary laws give us an indication that public health is something which is fundamental to good ethics and good Christian ethics. We need to look at that. We need also, to be honest, is there a difference between having McDonald's and having a pig liver inserted surgically? I hope you all enjoyed your pork today. And in eating your pork today, you absorbed it in a particular way. When xenotransplantation first started, I had an idea for a book. So I thought, wouldn't it be great to get a book where you go all the different religions, all the different moral views, talking about xenotransplantation? So I phoned up a nice tame Muslim, if there is such a thing, and a nice tame Buddhist, and a nice tame Jewish rabbi, and said, you know, I'm thinking about this book, and you know, what I want to know is, what's the Jewish perspective? What's the Muslim perspective? What's the Buddhist perspective? No issue. Now, it's interesting that the Muslim and the Buddhist, they said you must never, ever cross the species line. They wouldn't take organs from animals. But the rabbi, he was a little bit more down to earth. He said, well, as long as you don't eat it and it doesn't pass the mouth, that's all right. You can save human life as long as it doesn't cross the lips and is ingested in that kind of way. Does the method of absorption make a difference? Peter Singer's attack on Christianity in particular, and it's very interesting how he attacks both the doctrine of creation over and against evolution, and attacks particularly the notion that human beings are made in the image of God. Both of these he regards as lies. It's very important that we resist both of those attacks. He accuses human beings of being what he calls speciesist. We indulge and we protect our own species. And I think that we should plead guilty to that. Yes, we do, because we believe there is something special and fundamental about human beings made in the image of God, which give them a worth, a dignity that is far beyond what animal kingdom. That doesn't mean to say we do anything with the animal kingdom. There are ways in which the clear creation pattern is that we are good stewards. It's interesting that in the Old Testament, the picture is of a shepherd king. The shepherd king looks after the flock, cares for the flock, and recognizes that he is answerable to God. You don't use the created order or animals just for ourselves and for our own pleasure. We use them as part of our stewardship before God, and we eat to live rather than eat for sport. Speciesism. How can we properly respond to that kind of attack? But Singer goes a stage further, and not just Singer, others have argued this as well. Animals have rights. Now, I confess an unease about rights talk, an unease about human rights talk, because I believe that what we've done is we have baptized a Western liberal philosophy, particularly a 17th century view of humanity, and we've tried to Christianize it. The Bible doesn't talk about rights. The Bible talks about duties. The Bible talks about responsibilities. The Bible talks about what we are due to God, not about what rights we have before God. And I think that we need to be much more self-critical and other critical when we look at the issue of rights. But animals, well, they've looked hard at this question. Do animals have rights? And in the UK, we're now suggesting animals don't have rights, they have interests. They have interests. They have an interest in being cared for. They have an interest in having their life preserved. And we have responsibilities towards animals to limit their suffering, not to kill them needlessly or heedlessly, but to be concerned about their well-being. But that does not make them people who have rights. Now, if there are rights at all, and I'm not sure there are, and if there are rights, then they're legal rights rather than natural rights, which I don't pretend to understand. But I'm happy if anybody will like to enlighten me to be convinced otherwise. Do animals have rights, and how should we respond to them? Animals have claims. Animals have claims, but so do human beings. And we have to look at humanity and suffering humanity and needy humanity and ask whether or not we have a greater responsibility to preserve the well-being, the flourishing of human beings. Our duties should be expressed in care and concern. In the opening invocation, in the opening introduction today, we were reminded that we are to love not just God, but to love our neighbor as ourselves. In loving our neighbor, how do we show care and concern? All of us will be in hospital. I have great praise for the American healthcare system. I had six arteries bypassed just last September, and I'm living proof that the American healthcare system works and that the European healthcare system doesn't work, is the other side of that, sadly. But in that context, I was amazed how many people came to visit me. Even two students came up here from Southern to visit me up in Illinois. And I was very touched by that, but I was touched by how many people made the effort to come into hospital. You will all be in hospital. Hopefully, you won't all necessarily be patients, but you'll all have family members. You'll all have members of your congregations that you are going to seek to minister to. When we go into hospital, we see people often in extreme pain whose lives are tragically circumscribed because they're unable to do the normal things of life. How do we express our care? How do we express our love? How do we do appropriate research rather than inappropriate research? When it comes to xenotransplantation, as indeed when it comes to all medical research, and we could this morning have talked about, and this afternoon talked about genetics, we could have talked about a whole range. I want to emphasize the importance of having controls. Controls which look after the patient and protect the patient. Controls which look after the public and protect the public. One of the things that we're seeing here and in Canada are what you call town hall meetings, where there's a genuine attempt to engage the public. I want to engage the Christian public. How often have we had sermons on ethical issues? How often are we really addressing ethical questions? Because, you know, I'll give you a little tip. If ever you're traveling and you want to be left alone, when people say, "What do you do for a living?" say, "I teach philosophy." I've never, ever had anybody say, "Wow, a real-life philosopher, have I got a philosophical problem for you?" No, but if I say I teach ethics, they all have a friend, and the friend has a problem, and they know a remarkable detail of their friend's problem, and they're happy to tell me about their problem, their friend's problem, sorry, and ethical issues. You can't watch the news, you can't look at TV, you can't listen to the radio, you can't read the newspaper without knowing ethics is alive and well, and we need to address these issues in the context of the church. We have a responsibility to protect the public, but also the scientist. When research began, there was a very simple test. We would not allow research if a researcher would not do it to himself. If he was willing to do it to himself, they said that was all right. Then we discovered that some researchers will do anything to themselves. So then we had a second rule. Would you do it to a member of your family? And we discovered that some researchers will do anything to their family for the sake. So now we've had to introduce a very complex system controlling the research which is permitted. And it needs to be controlled. Just give you one example. We had a heart specialist who wanted to do a special research trial. This was a very special research trial which involved giving people a mild heart attack. And if they had a mild heart attack, his argument was, when they have a major heart attack, they'll do really well because they've had a trial run. And we turned him down. The ethics committee and the University of Oxford said, no, you're not going to do that. And we have a provision, if you don't like our decision, you can come and give a personal presentation. He came along. He said, I don't know what's wrong with you people. We are, you know, I've been 30 years treating people suffering from heart problems, and now I'm sure this is the answer. Give people a mild heart attack, and they will do well if they have a major event. We said, well, how can you guarantee it will be a mild heart attack? He said, that's difficult, but we'll manage somehow. He said, you know, I've got 20 people who are willing to have a mild heart attack. I said, where did you get these 20 people from? Well, they're all heart patients of mine. Now, you see, they were not able to say to this doctor, thank you for all that you're doing for me, but actually I don't want to be a guinea pig in your experiment. How do we begin to control medical research? And we do need to control it because there are some researchers. Harvard have announced that they're going to go ahead with stem cell research in spite of the attitude of American society, in spite of the attitude of President Bush, in spite of a concern worldwide that there are some lines in stem cell research that we ought not to cross. And that argument is, we've got the money, we've got the ability, we can make a difference. Does the end always justify the means? But there's one thing I want to say in closing before we have discussion. There's something far deeper at work in our society that we as Christian, particularly Christian pastors and preachers, need to identify. And that is a fear of death. I've been in hospital after hospital. I've talked to medical and nursing audience after audience. And I've been trying to understand why are people going to such extremes in research, genetic research, stem cell research, xenotransplantation research? Why are they pushing at the envelope and the limits all the time? And the answer is because they are terrified of death. My mother had serious heart problems, and when she eventually, after years of medical intervention, died, and the doctor, almost in tears, said, I'm really sorry. I said, what are you sorry about? You've kept her alive for about 7 years. He said, we failed. And I think of a doctor who told me, people don't get to die in my ward. You see, there is in our society a fear of death, an inability to come to terms with the reality of death and what happens after death. We have an opportunity as Christians to address that in society. And would that Christian funerals differed from secular funerals? But so often there is absolutely no difference. There is no sense of the life everlasting. There is no sense of being with Christ, which is far better. There's no sense of grieving with hope. Of course we grieve, because to lose loved ones is terrible and tragic. But we grieve not as those who are without hope. Somehow we have to address this attitude of death. And I try to challenge medical audiences about why they are so afraid of dying, why they want to resist death at all costs by all means, and whether or not we need to come to terms with our humanity and the fact that there is something quite different, something quite fundamental, something quite transforming, which we find in Christ. Life after death, our attitude towards death, our attitude towards animal, our attitude towards technology, and our attitude towards setting limits. I was taught to stand up, to speak up, and to shut up. So we have 15 minutes left for questions starting from now. Well, I really enjoyed those questions. That was great. Is anybody any comment they want to make, any questions they want to ask? As they say in the wedding service, speak now. or forever hold your peace.
This is more of a medical question, I think. What is it about pigs that makes them so compatible with human beings?
What is it about pigs that makes them so compatible with human beings is that pigs are very simple physiological animals. Their liver and their kidney operate in a very similar way to human liver and kidney. And so it's very easy to take an organ, whether it's a heart, liver, or kidney, from a pig and to use it to function well. The other thing is it's also very easy for us to modify, genetically modify pigs. And so pigs are the animal of choice. The other reason is it only takes you 6 months to grow a full pig. And now with transgenic pigs, it's only 6 months. And so if you have a loved one who has a disease and they're diagnosed today, in 6 months, we could have a pig which would produce an organ that they could use. So for physiology, function, and the time growth.
You mentioned controlling the experiments and controlling the researchers and such. Where do you feel that legislation, governments and all are going to come in? We've heard talk about passing legislation against stem cell research in the States, but then we also hear these same people saying they'll pick up and go to a third world country or somewhere where there is no legislation against this. So where do you see that resolve where the state is actually coming in and trying to control this? What are the developments?
I think this is really crucial. One of my disappointments about the Bush announcement when stem cell research was that it only limited federal-funded research rather than research itself. And I think that if we have rules, there should be rules which apply not only nationally but internationally. And what we're finding more and more is there is a move towards consensus because people are very concerned. The major discussion topic last week was xenotourism. They're terrified that Americans are becoming tourists, touring the world, not just for human organs, which you can get. China, you can fix a date for an execution, and they will execute that criminal so that you can get the liver, the kidney for a certain sum, and you can jump the queue here. Well, it's not just that kind of tourism. It's actually going to settings where they are doing xenotransplantation. Now, in academia and in medical research, what people want is a reputation. But they want a reputation which is based on peer review. They want their colleagues to say, we appreciate you. And that's where the peer group review makes a difference. And if respecting and good academically sound journals refuse to accept these kinds of research projects, they will die out. No matter how much money they have, they will not actually make that difference. And so I think that, first of all, legally, secondly, internationally, and thirdly, academically, we can begin to exercise control. And we've certainly found that there are areas of research now where the legality, the financial control, and the peer group review is such that research is now no longer functioning or flourishing in certain areas.
Could you give any examples where you feel proper controls are presently in place for any form of xenotransplantation?
It's very interesting that there are two particular things that the Council of Europe and the British government, and with it there are 43 countries which have signed the claim. First of all, they've said before you have a xenotransplantation, you must not only have the permission and the commitment of the individual to recognize lifelong surveillance and that he or she would end up in isolation if that problem arose, but also all the family members and all the sexual contacts. Now that's a major, major control. Also, the control is over how the animal is bred, how the animal is genetically modified, the conditions under which the animal is kept, the conditions under which the animal is killed, and all of these are in place before the first xenotransplant takes place. Now, it's a very interesting example of not closing the stable door after the horse has bolted, but being proactive. What I've been trying to do with genetics researchers, stem cell researchers, people who are engaged in the front line, is to say to them, all right, what will you be able to do 10, 15 years down the line, and what controls must we put in place now? Now, it's not that we are trying to stop them. It's interesting that when I first went into medical ethics, and with geneticists in particular, they have been coming to me and to people like me and saying, we need help. We know we can do these things, but we're not sure we ought to do them. We need to have some kind of control, and we need to carry the public. The public needs to be comfortable, and that's where we can mobilize public opinion. We can make a difference. And they don't have to be spirit-filled Bible believers to write to congressmen. They don't have to be spirit-filled Bible believers to write to the president, to give a call to the White House. We can actually make a difference about legislation and about being proactive rather than reactive. The history of the church is we have reacted. We've waited for the world to do something, then we've reacted. We have some of the finest scientists who are in our churches Sunday by Sunday. We should be sitting down with them and saying, all right, what's going to happen next? What's going to happen in 5 years' time? And how now can we begin to put in constructive, proper kind of restraints which will help human beings on the one side be safeguarded and the other flourish?
I'm curious as far as how many, as far as when you're describing humanity and the human sense of things, if a person has a cornea transplant from a pig today, next year they have a liver transplant from another animal, 5 years down the road they have a heart transplant, is there a point when we say they're not human anymore? You know what I mean?
Yes, indeed, there is a point where we'd say people are no longer human, and this is why we have to ask fundamentally, what is the sense of identity? And this is where the real challenge, I believe, comes, because we believe that identity is found in our relationship with God. For secular people, identity is found in brain function. And more now machines are able to replicate and to replace part of that brain function. And so the challenge, I think, is not going to come from animals. The challenge is actually going to come from machines. And whether or not the mind is just a machine, or whether we believe there's something fundamental about the spiritual nature of human being from the very moment of conception, and whether or not we need to hold to that truth, express that truth in a winsome kind of way. And that's going to be, I think, the fundamental question, whether or not brain, which is why people are deeply, in secular society, they're deeply uneasy about brain transplant. They're uneasy because they're saying, well, what happens to the individual? What happens to his or her memories? You know, isn't that what a person really is? How could you have somebody else's memory, somebody else's thoughts inserted? I remember, I think it was the second or third time I was in Louisville, they transplanted a hand, a human hand, and one of the local TV companies came to the campus and interviewed me. And they said, you know, what did I think about this? And I said, well, I wonder how the wife will feel that her husband's hand is touching somebody else's hair. And then they began to do eye transplants. And here, you know, your wife's eye is looking at someone else, somebody else's child. How do we feel about that? So we have a view of integrity. It's not just about bits. It's about the totality of the individual. And it's about the spiritual nature of humanity. One more. The best for last.
What kind of controls are in place to, as far as parents making decisions for xenotransplant on children?
This is a very frightening kind of question, because in all research we've discovered that if you have a low income, you will allow doctors to do anything to your children. If you are desperate, you will allow medicine to do anything to your children. And so actually asking parents is not the best way forward. And so there's a real tension here. To what extent do children belong to their parents, and to what extent do we in society have a greater responsibility for our children? Now, if you look at the area of child abuse, we don't say, well, leave it up to the parents to sort out, because parents abuse their children, and parents allow terrible things to happen to their children. So I think as a community, we have to put in restrictions which are stronger than what parents will be allowed to do. So on the one side, you ought not to be doing an operation on a child, xenotransplantation, without the parents' permission. But even if the parents give permission, that's not going to be enough, because we have to have a stronger level of control than that. And with that kind of level of control, there's some hope that we'll be able then to lead to human flourishing and the flourishing of children. It's always hard when a child dies, but we need to think not just about the child himself, herself. We need to think about the long-term effect on society as a whole. And once an operation is permitted, then the floodgates will open. Thank you all very much.